I'm Ann. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ann.
And it's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome all the new people who are here for the first conference in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know it's 7:30 in California, and my brain has not woke up yet. I would like to thank the committee for asking me to come here. I met Sam and John down in Biloxi last year, and we were kind of kidding, and John said, I'll see you in Miami, and I said, sure, you know. And so here I am. I hope God has arrived at the same time I did. I would like to thank John and Lori, who came and picked me up at the airport, and for waiting for me. I was a little late. Yeah, so far, everything is wonderful. I'm not too sure. I talked to Gisela this morning, and I guess you have a lot of muggings out here. It's worse in California. I want you to know that your Al-Anon speaker tomorrow morning has got us alcoholics running around like we know better. I ran and got her coffee and brought it back to her, and then Ted goes out there and he comes back and brings her a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting up here looking and I'm thinking, my God, and these guys think that us alcoholics, you know, we're here to entertain them. Everybody's waiting on her, you know, getting her coffee. So don't complain to me this weekend, Vinoy. You know, I'm watching this whole action here. I'm scared. That's what I am. Vinoy. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just celebrated a birthday on June 16th. I just turned 19. And By the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they say it takes what it takes to get here, and I want you to know it's taken every bit of me to stay in the time that I've been here. I had not planned to stay this long, folks. I had just planned to come in and learn how to drink socially, and then I was going to go out there and really live. I had heard when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the very, very first time I'd come here, I was 23 years of age, and I looked around Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were all very old. I mean, they were 35 and over. And I thought, God, they got one foot in the grave and the other in the banana peels ready to slide in any minute. And I most certainly did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not know what an alcoholic was, but I most certainly was not one of those. And I left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous 8 months later. I was all of 24 when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I weighed 85 pounds, and I had malnutrition and starting to cirrhosis of the liver. My liver was very enlarged up till I was a year and a half sober. And I still did not want what you had. You know, you hear it say, if you want what we have, I wanted your husband, and I wanted your car, and I wanted your house. I didn't know those other things that you had or I wanted. I looked around, I thought, no, there's not too much here. I want what they have, maybe their husband or their car or their home or their pocketbook, but that was about it. I didn't understand for a long time what you were trying to tell me what you had here. And what you have here is a way of living. And you also said, I heard very early in my sobriety that there was a mental twist. And I immediately knew that I would get that mental twist untwisted and I would be on my way. And I keep coming back because I've still got a lot of bends in that mental twist. And I am one of those that will probably keep coming back for the rest of my life one day at a time. I get done with one thing and I find a new thing wrong with me, you know. I better not say this. Pass. I understand Sam sent out a letter saying that we were not to swear from the podium, and I told Vinoy, I said, well, I didn't read that, because I said, I've got an excuse, I don't read. And so this morning she explained it to me in detail on what I was to say and not to say from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I promise I won't swear. I gave that up a long time ago. The first time I ever talked at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was a guy named Bob Lemke, and he wouldn't invite me back to his meeting for about 5 years later because he said the paint fell off the walls. I am so grateful that that was not one of the requirements that I would have to stop swearing, because where I come from, swearing is a second language. And I come from Ireland, and even the priests swear over there. They just don't think anything of it. Yeah, I am truly, truly grateful to the people that I came into in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I want you to understand, if you're new here today, that was not a word that I like to use. It's called gratitude. I used to kind of want to throw up when they talked about how grateful they were, because I was most certainly was not grateful. But I am really grateful to those people that were there for me when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, those old-timers. Because if it wasn't for those old-timers, I don't believe I would be here today. I believe that they gave me a foundation, and they told me what Alcoholics Anonymous was and what Alcoholics Anonymous was not. And they talked about this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talked about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and how these 12 steps were going to change my life. I couldn't understand that for a long time, what they meant, how this was going to work for me. They told me that I was to go to a lot of meetings, and I went to a lot of meetings. I still go to a lot of meetings. I go to probably more meetings than most newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I need Alcoholics Anonymous more today than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really believe I have a lot more to lose today than I did when I got here. And I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about the things that I have found inside of me, and that you've given me some stability in my life through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to share me. I do everything backwards. I even tell my story backwards, so you're going to have to bear with me. I usually talk about the program first, and then we get into the story. And that goes along with all my other illnesses. I don't know how to share me other than to share the steps with you and what I found for me in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is the program, is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned a long time ago that I have tailor-made a program that fits me. And my program may not fit you, but it fits me, and it fits me well. I've tried on a lot of your programs, but they didn't fit quite as well as the one I have fit for myself today. And I also learned that I tried to get a lot of people to work the program when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted somebody to do it for me, because I knew that if you did this for me, then it would be right. And I am so truly, truly grateful that you did not do it for me, because you would have done it all wrong. And it would not fit as comfortable as it fits for me today and working those steps for myself. But believe me, I tried desperately, very desperately for the first couple of years of my sobriety to make you do this for me. And you did in a sense, and you made me do it for myself. And the first step says that we admit we're powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable. Now, I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol, but I could not admit my life was unmanageable. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I drank too much coffee. In fact, I never drank the stuff until I got here. Yeah, but I could not admit my life was unmanageable because I never managed my life. I still have a hard time identifying with drunks who are out there thinking about when they do it or what, if they're going to drink or not going to drink. I roared right through my life. I thought about something and I did it and I suffered the consequences of it later. I'd like to tell you that I've taken the second half of that step 100% and I haven't. Because my life today can get very unmanageable, and I have to remember that my life is unmanageable and I have no business trying to manage your life or my life or anybody else's life. I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous I truly miss my calling in life. I should have been into management. I would have been marvelous at it. There's a part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says that God is the director and we're the agents, and I always want to be the director and let him be the agent. So I haven't taken the second half of that step 100% for me. I'm always going back and working on that and letting go one more time. And the second step says that we came to believe the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I came to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous that you could restore me to sanity. I'm going to be the first saint in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never grown with a lot of dignity. I just, you know, I kind of grow with dragging my feet and getting pushed and shoved. And I went through a lot of insanity a couple of years ago. And I've had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on tape way before anybody ever thought of putting it on tape. This gal told me to listen to chapter 4, which is a chapter to the agnostic, you see. When I found a higher power within me, God never moves from me. I move from God. I move from him a lot. And when I want to do something and I get into self-will, it's like, you know, God who? I have to learn my lessons hard. And so I listened to that because I was going through a lot of emotional turmoil and a lot of pain. And I don't grow with grace. I grow with tears and I kick and I scream. I listened to that tape and I listened. And in there it says that God either is or he isn't, and God is for me today. Has to be, because there is nothing else, but there is. It has to be a power greater than myself. And that really got me through that phase in my life at that time. And I believe that with all my heart. The third step, they want me to make a decision. I don't know about you, but I couldn't make a decision when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a decision. If you and I were out to lunch and we were going to decide whether you were going to pay for it or I was going to pay for it, I'd screw up a free lunch because I couldn't make a decision. And so I couldn't make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of something I couldn't feel or touch. You know, if you was tall, dark, and handsome, I could make a decision real fast. But if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to find out real fast that you joined a real bunch of lot of narrow-minded people. That's not the kind of higher power they had in mind for me when I got here. And so I made a decision at that time in my life to turn my will and my life over to the care of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, not one particular person, but a group of people. And that worked for me until I could find something within me. And I was 2.5 years sober when I really believed, or I took that third step, when I really was surrendered and I was really brought to my knees and I really found a power greater than myself within myself. And that was when I really knew that there was nothing that could ever happen to me again, that God truly had a plan for my life. And when I stay in that state of mind, it always works real good for me. And stuff, but a lot of times I move. Like I said, I just kind of move. He doesn't move, I move. Because I was born of free will, and he gave me abundance of will. And it's called self-will ran riot for me. And I have to get back in alignment in that center part of me with that power greater than myself. Now, the fourth step, they want me to take an inventory, and I figured that was for those of you who drank for 15 or 20 years. You're much sicker than those of us who drank for 10 years. I thought, you know, I'm not going to do that one. And there was this guy in my home group, and I think every home group has one of them. His name was John Brown, and his wife was my sponsor. And John was a great big guy. He stood about 6'4" and weighed 280 pounds. I always give his weight wrong and his height wrong, but that's how he looked, real big, and he had a big voice. And he used to come up to me, and in fact, I could never leave their house until 2 o'clock in the morning. Every night I stayed there till 2 because I was a bar drinker, and so they planned it that way, so I would have to go home, and it was 2 o'clock. And he came up to me, and he was kind of shaking his finger. You know, one of those to get right in your face, you know, that type of AA, with a real deep voice. And I was scared of John. He's probably the only person in Alcoholics Anonymous I had a twinge of fear, with a little fear and a little hate and a little anger going there. And he said, "Hey, kid," he said, "you're going to have a birthday pretty soon, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, John, I am." And he said, "Have you done the fourth and fifth step?" And I said, "No, John, I haven't, and I'm not going to. That's for those of you who drank for much more years than I did, and you're much sicker than I." And he said, "If you don't do that fourth and fifth step," he said, "on your birthday," he said, "I'm going to get up at the podium, and I'm going to announce all over Huntington Beach not to listen to you and not work in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." I want you to know, I took my very first inventory under pressure. I mean, just absolute total pressure. I changed my color of my hair again. I'm back to being a redhead. Every time I go through changes, I change the color of my hair. Now, I know it's an inside job, but I change the outsides before I get to the insides. But at that time, I used to wear my hair flaming red. I used to wear it mixed sparkling sherry and flame together. It was bright. Boy, it was real bright. And they used to call me Crazy Annie, and I just knew that, you know, if I didn't do that inventory, they would know that I wasn't working the lousy program, and that was what was wrong with me, and I thought I didn't want them to think that of me. So I went home, and I went out to Thrifty Drug, and I picked up a lot of stuff for his wife, and I got a lot of paper, and I got a lot of different colors of pencils and pens, and I called her up, and I said, "I'm coming to your house on Monday night, and we're going to work the fourth step," and she said, "Okay," and I got over there. Now, I didn't drive a car for the first 4.5 years of my sobriety, and for those of you who don't drive cars here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to tell you how to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never gone without getting to a meeting or getting home from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we get a lot of this at home, is that because they get 502s and they say, "Well, I can't get to a meeting because, you know, I don't drive." And they always give you a list, at least of my home group and different groups I went to. They always give us a list of meetings, and you always check out who is, a list of names and phone numbers, and who's newer than you. And I used to go down the list, and I knew who was newer than me, maybe 2 or 3 days newer than me, not much. And I would say, "If you don't come and pick me up and I die from this disease, it's going to be your fault." So, you know, I never went without a ride. So they come and get me and take me to a meeting because, see, you learn real fast because, see, I was loaded with guilt when I came here. And most newcomers were just loaded with guilt and, you know, self-loading remorse, and were just so scared. So I just knew that they were guilty. Now, I don't want you to know, don't do that to old-timers because they lose that. And they'll just tell you to take a bus or walk is what they'll tell you. So don't try that one. You have to get somebody newer than you, and they will come and get you. So I never had a problem getting to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called somebody, and they took me over to my sponsors, and I went over there with all this stuff, and I handed her all this stuff, and I sat there on the kitchen table, and she looked at all this, and I'm pushing it over to her, and she said, "What's all this for?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to tell you all about it. You start writing, you know." And she kind of looked at me, another very narrow-minded person, and you know, she looked at me, and she said, "Honey, I've done my inventory." And I said, "Now you get to do mine." And she said, no. She said, I'm not going to do your inventory. And I had some secrets, and there were my secrets, and I wasn't going to tell anybody, because I'd learned to live with them, and I'd learned to work with them, and I'd learned to do what I had to do with them. And I got very angry, and that was the only emotion I knew. And when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was loaded with anger, just rage. It was nothing for me to throw a chair down in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would never tell me. I knew eventually you were going to tell me to leave, and they never told me to leave. They'd always say, "Keep coming back." I was so disappointed when I found out they were telling everybody to keep coming back. You know, I really thought they singled me out. You know, I'd fly out of meetings, and someone would come flying out after me, you know, and just bring me back into the meeting. And I was disappointed when I found out they weren't just telling me to keep coming back. Everybody got that. You know, they told that to everybody. And so I argued with her, and I got very angry, and I went home, and I called her on the phone, and for the next 2 weeks, all I would get, I swear to God, she had a tape recorder, and it would say, right, and I'd just hang up, you know. So finally I had to tell her, and this has got absolutely nothing to do with my disease of alcoholism. It's got to do where I came from. We've got the educated Irish sitting up here at the podium, we've got the uneducated Irish at the podium, and there's nothing like an educated Irish. They're the worst kind, believe me. I mean, they really can destroy you, you know. And I didn't know how to read or didn't know how to write when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's got nothing to do with my disease of alcoholism. It's got to do with where I came from. And what I found out, because alcoholism does not choose his victims. It does not say, "We're going to get you, we're going to get you, and we're going to get that one." Alcoholism, whether you're educated or not educated, overeducated or undereducated, if you have the disease of alcoholism, you have the disease of alcoholism. And because of that, there's been many, many special people that have come into my life, and there happen to be teachers in the teaching profession that took an interest in my case way back then and got to know me and got to know what was wrong with me, and they took me to certain professional people who were psychologists and or psychiatrists in that field, in the educational field, that ran a battery of tests, and I've got tapes and I got papers and I got all kinds of things to prove to you that I got this particular thing that's wrong with me. And what I was that I have a thing called dyslexia, and I have seen everything in reverse all my life. And they said my perception was so off. Now, they tell me that alcoholism is a disease of the perception. Now, I come by mine real honesty. Honestly, I don't know what the rest of you are doing here today, you know. And I was able to tell this lady, and she said, "That's okay." She said, "You do it the best way you know how." And I did. I did it the best way I knew how. I made a lot of marks. And because of coming from Ireland and because of these people not knowing what was wrong and they didn't know what to deal with me, I was labeled stupid, dumb, and I was put in dunce's corners, and I was with big dunce's hats on my head, and I got really, it was just very devastating, and it was very humiliating, and my memories of school were absolutely horrid. That I never thought that I would be able to go into a classroom again. And in 1983, and I know it's a long time from 68 to 83, but it took you a long time to get this inner child in me quiet enough and serene enough and calm enough to take me to school and put me through school. And I would go and I would leave and I would go and I would leave. And I graduated in 1983. And I do know how to read, and I don't write real well. And if you want a letter from me, don't ask me to write. I won't write. I will call you. Because I still do letters in reverse. And I did graduate from high school. And I was able, she said, "You do it," and I did it, and I made a lot of marks. And in step 6 into 12 and 12, it says that wishful thinking is a character defect. And I do wish today that I had kept that inventory, you know, because there is no comparison to the girl that took that inventory and the woman that stands before you tonight. Absolutely none whatsoever. And so I went to that woman, and I did that fifth step with her, and I'm absolutely, totally positive she pointed out some of my character defects. Now, I don't know about you, but when I arrived here at Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no character defects. It is very difficult to have character defects when you've got no character to start with, you know, and they're looking for character defects. I have a lot of character defects today, and, you know, and God has removed those character defects of me that stand in the way of me helping my fellow man or me hurting me. I want to share one of my character defects with you, and it's very brief, and I haven't done it in a while, so you can all hold on to your wallets and your purses. When I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't a thief until I got sober. And when I got sober, I became a thief. And I did some stealing, and I did everything to get rid of this, you know. And if you've never been a thief, you have no idea. Your palms of your hands sweat, and you just shake all over it. You know, it used to be, relief was just to swallow away. Now it's just to steal away. And so I ended up talking. I shared in a meeting, and I got rid of that. God removed that from me. For many, 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 many years, it was removed. And after I quit smoking in August, now I'd like to tell you and leave you with the illusion that I'll have 2 years this August from smoking, and I'd be lying to you because I cheated in December, and I was doing a little social smoking. And, you know, I was... You know, one here and one there until my head said, you know, you're doing so well in the social smoking, we probably could do a little social drinking. I thought, oh, well, this is where we draw the line. But when I quit smoking at that time, it'd be 2 years this August, I started to steal. And I want you to know I'm not a big thief. I'm a very petty thief. And I was at the market, and I go into the market, and I'm up at the grocery checkout stand. I got $200, and I see this dentine gum, and I go to take the gum, and I say, you're not going to take the gum. Yes, we are going to take the gum. That's all at 55 cents, you know. And I said, no, we're not going to take it. Yes, we are going to take it, so we take it. And so I go to a meeting, and I thought, shit, I got to tell somebody. So I go to a meeting, and I share at the meeting. I said, I don't want to start this because I don't want anyone coming over with 17 years of sobriety over to Orange County Jail picking me up. You know, some of those lawyers and judges that I know over there saying, oh, my God, we knew this was going to happened to her, and here she is in Orange County Jail. And I thought, I shared it. But the next thing I steal is a piece of celery, one lousy celery stalk. Not the whole bunch, you know, the whole thing. I take one thing. I was making tuna salad, and I just wanted one stalk. And, I'm Catholic, and I even though I don't practice it today, but you know, those old ideas are hard to kill. And I thought, you know, I rationalized it, you know, and I thought it's better to steal than to waste. It's a bigger sin to waste, right? So I take the celery thing and I take it home. I shared that at a meeting one time, and this little old lady came up to me and she said, "Oh, I'm so glad you shared that." She said, "I steal radishes." So I told her, I said, "Let's get together and we'll steal a whole salad." So I go home and I call Mary Reagan, who's my sponsor, and I said, "God, Mary, I said, I got to stop this. You know, I said, I stole a stock of celery." And she said, "Annie," she said, "you're just going to have to go back up to the produce man, and you're really going to have to tell him that you're stealing his celery." So, Mary, you got to be kidding. I said, "Give me a break. I'm not going to go tell him that." She said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "Mary, you know, it says in step 5, we've made it to God, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs." I said, "No, I'm not going to go tell that produce man I stole a stalk of celery." She said, "Well, you better do something about it." She said, "Because you cannot be getting on the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're stealing and those newcomers." So I took it a little step further. I decided that I had to do something about this problem. And so I went up to the store, and I shop at 7 o'clock in the morning is what I shop. I can't stand people, so I'm out there at 7 in the morning. And I, when there's nobody around, right? So I go over to the manager, who I know, and I said, "You know, I got this problem." And he said, "You do?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "I like to steal." And he looked at me and said, "What do you like to steal?" I said, "Everything." And I said, "Would you walk around the store with me just for a little while till I get over this obsession?" And so this poor guy walked around the store with me for the next couple of weeks. I believe me, this is no lie. So I walk around the store, and then I go in and I say, "I don't have it today. I'm okay. I'm not obsessed today. It was an obsession." So one day I'm up at the check stand and I get the dentine gum, and this guy Paul is checking me out, and I said, "Oh, I forgot my gum." And he said, he said, "You quit smoking." I said, "Yes, I quit smoking." And he said, "You know, I quit drinking some years ago." I said, "You did?" And I said, "So did I." And he said, "Do you know Bill W?" And I said, "No, I know Bill W. Yes, I know Bill W. I want you to know, we had a little AA meeting, and we usually have a little AA meeting every Thursday when I shop, and I will never steal again from Alpha Beta, you know, ever." And once I knew there was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous there, I knew. I just knew that they planted somebody, you know, and that's how my sobriety, you know, to watch me one more time. I'm being watched in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have not stolen in quite some time. So that is a character defect that comes back every once in a while. And it really is what it is. AA, somebody in AA will always have an answer for you. They told me I was going through a mourning process from smoking. And I thought, God, I thought, wonderful. So now I'm stealing. So it's mourning. So I am. That was one of the character defects that I've had. And step 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. That's a real difficult step for me. And it's got to be the hardest step in the world, is because my shortcomings do not show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really difficult to be short with you when you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and everybody's telling you you're wonderful and you're hugging you and kissing you and just, you know, it's just great to see you. But my shortcomings show up at home, in my household, with my husband and my 3 children. And for years, I would run to meetings and I would tell you, I really believe that is the last place I get to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is at home. I would run to meetings and I'd tell you what I was doing. And I was I was a child abuser. I abused my children long into my sobriety. And I'm not proud of that, but I did that. And I abused this man that I was married to. And I abused him way into my sobriety. I was chasing this man with knives. I'm talking about little knives. I'm talking about a big butcher knife. And I used to chase him. I still take the knife out every once in a while just to see if I get a reaction. See how much power I have here. And I used to chase him. I mean, I used to think if I kill him, I would be okay. Because, see, I was a blamer. I blamed everybody. I knew that it was his fault or I was the way I was. But then I went into that inventory. Everybody. It goes all the way back to my parents, to my grandparents is why I am the way I am. It's just real simple. I'm an alcoholic. And my instincts have always run riot somewhere. And when they go, when your instincts go run riot, there's bound to be problems in your life. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has teach me not to and one day at a time, and easy does it, and slow down. And I stopped chasing him with knives when my 3-year-old came one day and said, "Mommy, I'll get the knife for you." And I thought, you know, something's not quite right here, you know. I mean, these kids. So I'd like to tell you that I work step 7. It's still real hard. I do it, and that's when it shows up. It's in a house. But it's much better than it was then, and it's a lot better today, and I'm aware of that's what it is. And I did make a list of people I'd harmed, and I put me on top of that list. And you know, it's easier for me to forgive you today, you know, because, you see, I have to remember that this is, I have not reached a destiny in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm on a spiritual journey, and it's a continuation, and you continue to get experience, and you continue to grow, and you continue to change. You see, I thought I would just, everything would be wonderful, and that was it. And that's not the way it is. And it's easy for me to forgive you when you do some of your sneaky, slimy little things in your program today than it is, I'm taking everybody's inventory, than it is for me to forgive myself when I'm asked to do those things and I think I'm getting away where I'd never get away with anything. And I did go make those amends, direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I don't like to think that I gossip. I don't like to think I gossip about you. I don't gossip about you. I just report on you, and I'm just genuine concerned about your program. You know, and your program is not my business. Your program is God's business. And I've had to go to you, and I've had to make an amends to you, and because I've said things, not character assassinating, but just being genuine concerned, right? And I have to go to you and tell you I'm sorry that I said these things about you, or heard this, or heard that, or I condone to different things, because it's none of my business. It's absolutely none of my business. I'd like to tell you I take a written daily inventory. I don't take a written daily inventory. The only time you'll catch me take a written daily inventory is when I'm in a lot of excruciating pain and I keep repeating the same thing over and over, and I need to sit down and I need to write. And it was a time of my sobriety I couldn't promptly admit anything. My attitude was screw you and the donkey you rode up on was my attitude. I just could not promptly admit anything. I learned a long time ago that you went to bed and you went to sleep and you didn't give me another thought, and that upset me so much. It really upset me. I would stay up half of the night thinking how I was going to get you at the next meeting because you hurt my feelings or you said something that was really truth to me. And somebody told me that you went to bed and went to sleep and didn't give me another thought. And so I decided the way back then that I was going to give resentments, not have them. It's much easier to give them than to have them. The 11 steps are through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. That was a real difficult step for me. You know, when you're illiterate, it's a very, very difficult step. Meditation, that's a big word. I knew what medication was. I didn't know what meditation was. But I used to watch those old-timers in meetings, and they would kind of describe how they meditated. And for years, I used to sit in this old chair. I had a big red chair that I had, and I used to have the big book under my arm. I was a pacer. I used to pace back and forth. And I'd hold a big book under my arm, and I used to think that all this knowledge was going to go up through my arm and into my head, you see. And I'd walk back and forth, and so they would say they'd sat in this chair, and they'd close their eyes, and they'd get real quiet. Well, I never got quiet. I was 6 years sober before I finally got quiet. I finally understood why the old-timers kept saying to me, bring the body, the mind will follow, you know. The body would come, but I was out there somewhere else all the time. You know, I was just, my head would never stay in the meeting for, you know, 2 hours or an hour and a half, you know. So I was 6 years sober, and I realized all of me was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so excited. It was a spiritual awakening, to be honest with you. I thought, my God, I'm here, and I heard everything they said tonight. And I would sit in this chair, and I'd close my eyes, and I couldn't get the mind quiet, and I'd get into all these sexual things. I mean, far out sexual things. I could use some of those today. And I just was just way, way out. So I'd fall asleep, so I had to quit meditating. I gave it up. It was very bad for me. So I went to somebody one day, and I said to this man, I said, what is meditation? And he said, Annie, in Webster's Dictionary, the definition for meditation is a higher plane of thinking. And so, you know, it's really difficult to have a higher plane of thinking when your mind is always in the gutter and you're 9 months sober. You know, I like to believe through practicing that step in my life today that I have a higher plane of thinking due to practicing that step every day. And I'd like to tell you that I do it every day. And most times I do. I do it every day. I try not to fudge in that step. If I don't do it in the morning, I try and do it sometime during the day or evening, because that step promises me emotional and mental sobriety, and I have no illusions, none whatsoever, that I am here because of step 11, because I really believe that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I have a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual maintenance, and I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I need to have my spirit fed, and through how I get my spirit fed is through you, whether you're new or old or whether you're in between. My spirit is fed here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the ABC says that no human power could relieve me of my alcoholism, but God could and would if sought. And you see, I know that you can't relieve me of my alcoholism, but God can and will if I seek him on a daily basis. And through you, my higher power speaks to me through you. The 12 step haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I believe that the newcomer is the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that with all my heart, but I want you to know that I need the old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need the old-timer to let me know that I can get through some of the things that I'm going through. I'm living with somebody today who's practicing, and I don't like it, but nobody said I had to like it. But it couldn't have come at another time in my life, because this man did not drink when I first got sober and didn't drink for many, many years into my sobriety. And I don't talk about it too often, and I went to Al-Anon for a while, and I think that's really going to the bottom of the barrel when you have to go to Al-Anon. Sorry, Benoit. But I did go for a while. I gave these gals a year to get me together, and most of them knew me, because when I got sober, that's all it was in my area. It was a lot of Al-Anon women. There wasn't a lot of alcoholic women at that time. And the couple of AA women that were there, they were all working. You know, the few that were there, they worked, and they didn't go to they went to a lot of daytime meetings, didn't go to a lot of nighttime meetings. And so I had to depend on Al-Anons at that time in my life. And they said, I gave them a year, and they said it would take longer than that. I'd like to tell you I go to every week, but I don't. And this Al-Anon, my Al-Anon sponsor, told me, she says, isn't it wonderful you get to work the 12 step at home all the time? And I thought, go drop dead, Gloria. You know, I mean, you know, I don't think it's wonderful that I get to work the 12 step all the time at my house, you know, do a little 12 step work. And I'm getting better. I don't get, I used to get at the sink at the podium, and I would give some of my finest pitches I've given to this man, and he doesn't hear a word I say, you know. And I have to let him go, and I have to realize that, you know, I'm there because I'm supposed to be there, and I believe that. And there's a lot of reasons, a lot of good reasons for me to stay there. And I know that in God's time, you know, and Benoit said something very important to me this morning, and I heard it. I have always been very, very impatient, and I have to live through this to learn patience and learn tolerance and to have some compassion and to see that, you know, I don't like the disease of alcoholism. I don't like it at all, but nobody said I had to like it. All I have to do is walk through it. And so it gives me an opportunity to get out there and do the things that I need to do for me. And my kids are all doing okay, simply because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they are familiar with the disease of alcoholism. And they none of them go to Al-Anon or Alateen. They all seem to be very busy escaping through their own various little things that they escape through. They're not into any drugs or alcohol at this time, you know, at this time. I do encourage them to drink. If they're going to use anything, use alcohol. You know, we've got a program here for them. Yeah. to stay away from the other stuff, you know. I don't understand that other stuff, so I tell them, don't use that because I can't help you there. You'll have to go to another program for that, and I have no idea what they do over that side. So I want to back up here, and I know that I'm going to talk real fast, so hang on. And I want to share with you what it used to be like and what has happened. And I've shared a great deal with you already and where I come from as far as the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're the most important thing in your life. And if you don't get onto them, you know, I used to wonder how it works, you know. I used to wonder what, I think, Vinoy's husband mentioned last night that, you know, they went to another place and they had the secret. And the secret is, and I used to think that too. I used to think that they all knew how to do this and they had another, after I left, I used to stay up to 4 o'clock in the morning to see if I could catch them. You know, after I left, they all got together and they just knew how the secret was and they wouldn't tell me the secret. And the secret is and how it works. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And willingness is the key in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's in the chapter 5. And that's how it works for me. And it's in a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all there. It's all laid out for you. But I just thought they had this special secret they weren't sharing with me. And that inventory, and like I said, I've taken many, many inventories, and I want to go back to when I was very young because I'm one of those that I don't relate to those of you who were social drinkers and crossed over that invisible line and became alcoholics. When I started to drink, I went for it. I became alcoholic right away. And that's why I got here young. I would never have made it to 26. I believe that. I would have been dead. And I'm Irish and I'm Catholic. That gave me 2 strikes against me right off the bat. And now, if there's any Irish in the room today, I don't like to, you know, I want you to know this is my story. And I'm not talking about all of Ireland. I'm just talking about one little family in Ireland. And anything I like to say about the Irish is 2 problems we have. We're sexually suppressed and spiritually sick, and that covers a multitude of sin right there. And, I'm one of 10 children. I'm the 8th child out of 10, and my father's an alcoholic. And I did not know that my father was an alcoholic until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But all I know is that when my dad drank, there was a lot of absolutely disturbance that went on in that household when my dad drank. And on Friday night, he would either go to Flanagan's or Saturday night Flanagan's or downtown, and he'd come home, and he used to beat on my mother. There was a lot of abuse, a lot of beating. He beat on the Irish believe in keeping the woman in shape. And he used to beat on my mother, and there was a lot of name-calling, and there was a lot of stuff that went on. And I remember being upstairs in this room, and I put the pillow over my head, and I would ask God to please let him kill her, or maybe she'd kill him, or maybe I would die. And I got up the next morning, I had all these things going on inside of me, and I did not know how to label them. And what they were was guilt, remorse, and I was a bad child for thinking all these bad things of my parents. I went to Catholic school, not because we're rich, simply because that's all it was in the part of Ireland I come from. And you see, I tell you this part of my life because I believed I was getting ready for alcohol way before I ever picked up a drink. I truly, truly believed, or I had not found alcohol, I would have gone absolute stark raving mad. I truly believe that alcohol saved my sanity until I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and through you and your program of 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you put me back together and made me a whole person. I believe that with all my heart. I went to Catholic school, not because we're rich, simply because that's all there is in a part of Ireland I come from. And people have said to me, how come you didn't get an education if you went to Catholic school? I couldn't tell them the stuff that was going on in that house, and I couldn't retain anything, and I couldn't see when they put things, and I didn't want to be any more different than I was anyway in that that school setting, because I was a Donahue, and the Donahues were not known as being very well liked, or, you know, Jack Donahue's kids. There was so many of us, and they didn't think we were a very nice family, and I didn't want to be different one more time, because I knew I was different, and if I told them how I was seeing things, they would really label me more. And I wouldn't tell him anything. My first brainstorm was in second grade. I decided I was going to hit this nun because every morning we had catechism, and every morning I couldn't remember. I would try, and I could not retain it. And so she asked me the question, and I couldn't tell her. So she grabbed me out of the seat, and I upped and slapped her right across the face. And mother, there was a glass partition in this particular classroom, and Mother Superior was teaching next door, and she just happened to turn her head, and she just happened to see me hit her. And I stood there in front of 30 kids, and Mother Superior, and said, I didn't do it. You know, I don't know who did that, and I was to do that until I came to Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got caught in some hairy situations, and I would stand there and look at you straight in the eye and say, it wasn't me, it must have been somebody else. And they took me out of there, and they moved me to another grade, and I was to kneel in front of these 2 statues, and I assumed I was supposed to pray. And I always say 3 weeks, and it probably was a week, and I went back into this classroom, and I stood in front of these kids, and she had that round pointer in my back, pushing in my back for me to say it loud, to apologize. And I said I was sorry, and something else happened inside of me, and what happened inside of me was you against me, and it was always you against me from that time on. I used to have psychiatrists cry when I would tell them about some of the experiences I had at school. And I was sharing with Mary Reagan one day about all these horrible things that happened to me as a kid in school. And Mary looked at me and she said, "Honey," she said, "I know you really had it bad." She said, "You know, I had German nuns and they were trained by Hitler." So I want you to know that no matter what, there's always somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have a lot worse than you, you know. So I left school, and I got out of there, and I went to work in a factory that most of us do over there. And I had all those hopes and dreams that every other girl had. I was going to find me a nice Irish fella and get married and have children. And I am so truly, truly grateful that God doesn't answer stupid prayers. You know, I found alcohol and I found booze all in the same week. And this, my first drink was half a bottle of cognac. And this guy told me that if I drank this half a bottle of cognac, he would give me a pound note, which was equivalent to $3 in your money at that time. And I drank that thing and I didn't stop. And I drank it down and I got very, very sick. And I went into the bathroom and I threw it up. And I came back out and I said, "Give me my money. Give me my money." And he gave me the money and I went up to the bar. And if you know anything about the Irish culture, if you know how to name it, they will serve it. There is no age limit in Ireland. And I went up and I ordered another drink and I continued to drink. And something else happened to me. And what happened inside of me was that knot in the pit of my gut from the time I was 6 years of age was gone. And it didn't matter whether my father beat on my mother. And it didn't matter whether I had no education. It didn't matter whether there was no food in that house to eat. I had found the secret to living. Now, I didn't drink every day from that time on, but I drank at every opportunity from that time on. By the time I was 17 years of age, my father made the decision for me. I had absolutely nothing to do with this decision. He decided I should come to California because the streets were paved with gold. I've been here 26 years and I'm still looking for those streets paved with gold. And I just knew that it was going to be different. I knew it was going to be different, and I didn't know that until I came to you that that's alcoholic thinking. I knew that once I got away from this family, I just thought if I get away from this family, I was never going to tell a soul I was Irish. Not a soul was ever going to know I was Irish. I had it broke like I stepped off the boat, but I was never going to tell anybody I was Irish. I realized today that I'm truly, truly grateful to be Irish, and because I know that if it wasn't for the Irish, you could hold your AA meetings in a phone booth. You know? I know there's a lot of people that don't like that, but you know, my sponsor said the reason why God created whiskey was because he's afraid the Irish are going to take over the world, and that might be some truth in that. You know. You don't have to be Irish to belong, but it helps, you know, it truly helps. So I got on, and I remember my aunt taking me up to Dublin. She filled out all these papers, and I do have some people in my family who had to do that, and she did all this paperwork and got all that stuff ready for me, and I got on. I remember them taking me up to the plane. I remember asking my dad at this time, I remember saying to him, "Let me go to England." I'd never been anywhere in Ireland. I came from a little town, very small little town in Ireland, country girl, and I said, the only place I ever got in Ireland was Dublin to the zoo, and that was big time. And I remember saying to him, "Let me go to England. I got brothers over there, and let me stay there for a year, and I'd be glad to go on to the States." And he said, "No, the Queen of England has screwed up that half the family, and by God, she ain't going to screw up this half the family. The Queen of England has got blame for more Irish going wrong than anybody I know, you know." So, but I remember getting on that plane, and I remember the feeling was freedom. God, I wanted to be free. And I was so free, the feeling was freedom, and I didn't know that it was false freedom. It was freedom behind drinking booze. I was drinking champagne on that plane, and I got here, and I stayed with a family, and I was never to feel that feeling again until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it didn't happen for me in my first 90 days, and it didn't happen for me in my first 5 years of sobriety. I want you to know it's taken me a long time to be free and to be out of bondage of self, and today I can stand up here and I can tell you I'm a free spirit in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I choose to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life on a daily basis, and I really believe that for me today. I am not in bondage to anything today because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay with family for the next couple of years, and I drove these people absolutely, totally insane. I did go back and I did make an amends to these people, and they were truly grateful. I found a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. This woman wanted me to go to school, and she took me down to Redondo Beach High, and I always shook. I was shaking here this morning when I got up here, but I used to shake like really crazy, really outwardly. You know, when you're always, you're kind of schizo and paranoid, and you're just always looking behind you, and so scared that somebody's going to find out something about you. And remember, take me down to Redondo Beach High. I remember standing outside that office, and I was terrified of my peers. I never ran around with my peers because I was terrified of them. And I was standing outside the office, and I was shaking so bad because I couldn't go in and fill out those papers, and I did not want to go into that classroom, and I was kind of sliding down the door. I was going into a catatonic state of mind with absolute sheer fear somebody was going to find out something about me. And she looked at me, and she said, "Annie, you don't have to do this." That's one of the greatest freedoms I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I don't have to go down any alleys today. I don't have to hide today. My life is an open book today. There is nothing that I don't do that I am not ashamed or I'm not afraid to tell you. This is one of the freest places in the world. When I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm so safe and so free. And that's one of the gifts that you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I could be me here, and I am me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to sit out there and I'd say, who is me? Would the real Ann Parent please stand up, you know? And that was many, many people until I found the center of me. And when I found the center of me, I walked tall today because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That woman said I didn't have to do that, and I didn't have to do it. I ran around Redondo Beach Pier. I ran around a lot of people who use a lot of hard drugs, and I never got involved in drugs. And the only reason I didn't get involved in drugs was simply because I was absolutely terrified that if I was caught, I would be deported back to Ireland. And I am so grateful today that I didn't get involved in drugs, because I think I would still be doing the Thorazine shuffle at Norwalk Hospital looking for my medication. And I'm so glad that my main problem is alcohol, and I'm an alcoholic. And I moved on uptown. That woman took care of that. Now, if you want to know what I drank everything and anything anybody ever bought me. But when I bought, I drank Ripple. And I don't know if you got any Ripple drinkers here today, but if you've never got drunk on Ripple, I guarantee you've missed a trip. I mean, it was 37 cents a bottle, and it came in a long neck bottle, and you drank, got drunk on Ripple, and you drink water the next day, you got two drunks for the price of one. And I used to walk along Catalina Avenue with a paper sack. Now, I don't consider myself a wino. I guess I would be a winette. A paper sack with that hat, with that wine in the paper sack, and I used to wear jeans before they were ever fashionable, and I used to wear a t-shirt and those rubber go-aheads that people usually wear when they go camping for taking showers, and I walk along that street and I gave everybody the finger. I hated everybody, hated them. I just gave everybody a finger and I cussed everybody, and I had so much hate, and I couldn't stand the American people because, and you know, though I love the country, but all they ever talked about was education, and you got no education, there isn't much to talk about, you know, and I didn't want anything to do with the Irish because all they did was change addresses. They behaved the same way over here as they did over there, and I didn't want to be Irish. My God, I didn't want anybody to know I was Irish. So I moved on uptown. I took the lesser of two evils. I started running around with Mexicans. Now, my best friend in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is Angie, and if you know anything about Mexicans, her and I sat down one day, and we kind of dissected the two nationalities, and what we came up was the only difference between the Mexicans and the Irish is that we ate potatoes and they ate beans, you know. They drink hard, love hard, beat the hell out of you on Saturday night, whether you need it or not. So I started running around with a group of Mexicans, and I learned to speak Spanish like I was native to their tongue, except it was all swear words. I didn't learn anything else. And this guy was drinking. I'd long left these people, and I had kind of taken a downfall. I was in over in Gardena, and this horrible little place, and I was dating this guy, and I decided, Norm A., God rest his soul, always said, don't think when you drink. And I got to thinking one day. He had introduced me to the morning drink, and he was drinking in the morning. I was drinking in the afternoon, and then now I'm drinking in the morning, and I'm having a hard time holding jobs, and I wasn't holding jobs. And so I ended up thinking that he ought to marry me, and I hitchhiked all the way over to Torrance and Lomita, and I found him, and I proposed to him. Now, you could smell me before you could see me. I think one of our traditions, one of the neatest things I find for me is to be a woman alcoholic. Today, this morning I had a shower, I got clean clothes on, and, you know, I'm clean today. And I didn't always be clean. I'm not going to go into that, but I wasn't always this way. And it's kind of nice. It's really, really nice. I think the tradition says that we're attraction rather than promotion. And I like to think that I'm an attraction for Alcoholics Anonymous today, even if it's just being dressed up. Ended up finding him, and I proposed to him, and you could smell me before you could see me, and he said he wouldn't marry me, and my next thought was, I'm going to kill you. One less Mexican in this world, and we'll all be better off. Now, I know that I'm capable of doing anything when I'm under the influence of alcohol. I know that without a shadow of a doubt. I know that I'm capable of doing anything because alcohol is gives me a tremendous amount of courage, and I got him in the car, and I've never owned a driver's license until I was 4.5 years sober and pulled with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got him in the car, and I drove the car on the Harbor Freeway, and I turned the wheel of the car on the Harbor Freeway, and I went down 25 feet and took 25 feet of guardrail, down 30 feet in embankment, and I thought I killed me a Mexican. Now, what I learned out of that, folks, is that if you want to kill one Mexican, you got to kill the whole family. For some reason or another, they don't take too kindly to you messing with their people. I also learned that when you run with Mexican people, you don't ever yell cop. I yelled cop one time, and he got me in a phone booth, and he kicked the door, and he kicked me, and I yelled uncle. You see, I have no illusions, not something missing in my head. Normal people go home. I call out of the phone booth, and I go to the bar he's at, and I said, let's have a drink, and we'll discuss this. I learned in that inventory that I'm absolutely terrified of being abandoned. I'm absolutely terrified of being abandoned. I don't care what you do to me. don't leave me. For heaven's sakes, don't leave me. I will do, and I'm not saying that I didn't deserve a lot of stuff like God. I deserved every bit of it because it talks about somewhere in the 12 and 12 about bringing out the finer character defects in other people. I've been able to do that, and so here at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only difference is they haven't found it necessary to hit me in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only difference. And I was terrified of being abandoned, and I had to learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here, I would just die when people would, I get to know them, and then they would leave, and then I'd swear I'm never going to get to know anybody again, and I'm so scared they're going to leave me. And I learned here that you don't leave me, you go on to do what you have to do, and when we come back again, that we'll come back together, and the bond is always there. I didn't know that, and I would plug in, and I would stay somewhere forever. I also had another thing inside of me. I antagonized. To the point that I thought if I would get somebody to hit me, I always got hit for some reason, and I know the reason today was because I wanted somebody to kill that part of me, just kill her, just beat the hell out of her and kill her, and then I would be okay. And I learned here that if you kill that part of me, you kill all of me, and that's the 5% of me that you love here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up in Arizona with this man, and I ended up getting very drunk, very belligerent one more time. And four guys, I went out to backseat the car. I said some things to this Mexican guy's wife, and he didn't appreciate what I was saying. And I went out to backseat of a car, and I passed out, and four of them came out after me, and they pulled me out of the backseat of the car, and they worked me over, and they worked me over good. And this one guy said, we'll go get the truck, and we run over her. And the guy went and got the truck. And I used to have terrible, terrible nightmares for years into my sobriety, some of the places I've been and some of the things that happened to me. And this particular, these headlights come, and these three guys jump, and they run off. They run away, and I roll off the dirt road. I don't know where I got the sense to get off the dirt road. And I got off the dirt road, and my face looks like that Mack truck has ran over me. And I'm walking along the dirt road, and my dress is all torn, and my hair is full of gravel, and I need a drink. I'm the type of drunk, I live by four mailboxes, a Ralph's Market, or some sign. I have no idea where I am, and I'm never going to get back to Los Angeles again. And the guy comes along, and he picks me up, and we go get a bottle of wine, and we go to a dirty motel, and that's how I learned to solve my problems. I have no idea how to solve my problems until I came to Prong of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came to Prong of Alcoholics Anonymous, you talked a great deal about dying. I know what it's like to die. God, I know what it's like to die. And I hope I never forget that I know what it's like to die. I know what it's like to die out there drinking. I also know what it's like to die when you sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I died 1,000 times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I died out here because you told me that I had to let go of all my old ideas. And I knew where my old ideas took me. I didn't know where your new ideas were going to take me. And I literally died sitting in those chairs. I think, my God, I'm so scared. And if I don't try this and if it doesn't work, what's going to happen to me? And I am so grateful today that I did listen to you and I did try some of your ideas and that they did work, but I wasn't too sure, and I died in this little room. I ended up over in Gardena, and I used to call it my 4x4, and I literally died 1,000 times. Jim talked about his little room and Broadway, 7th and Broadway, that Skid Row, and he was trying to give the impression that he was really uptown, you know. It's, Skid Row is what it is, and I ended up in this little room in Gardena, and I used to call it 4x4, and I died 1,000 times in this little room. And I had a hot plate and I had a sink and I had to go down the hall to take a shower, and I didn't take too many showers at that time in my life because the only time I was ever relieved from this fear and this feeling of inadequacy and this horrible not feeling that I fit. I just figured everybody walked around not feeling they fit. The only time I was ever relieved from that was when I was under the influence of alcohol. That was the only time I ever felt free to say anything. I walked around holding my head down. I was so full of shame inside of me. And I ended up in this little room, and I died in that little room. 1,000 times I died in that little room. I remember I would start drinking to get up the courage to go down the hall to take a shower, and I'd always overshoot the mark. At this time in my life, I started to call Ireland because it was their fault. They should never have sent me to this country. It was my dad that did this to me. And how could he have done this to me? Why would he send me to this vast country with no education and no means of support and no... no friends, nobody to understand me. God, I ached for somebody to understand me. I ached all over for somebody to understand me. I remember lying in that bed one night and I was sucking off a vodka bottle and I would set out to find somebody to understand me. Yes, I always found somebody. I would get out there in those streets and I found somebody for a very brief moment. And I would find them and I'd get some understanding. And I would end up the same way because my mouth always got in the way and I ended up getting beat up, thrown out of cars one more time. I died in that little room for 6 months. I died in that little room, and I'd scream, God, just, I want somebody to understand me. I never asked for rooms full of people to understand me. I asked for one lousy person to understand me, and I know that I am so understood in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no, my case is not different, even though it almost killed me here, too. My case is not different here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm no different than anybody else sitting here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended, there's two very important people come into my life, and one gal named Carol Poole and the other gal named Ann Wilson, and Carol caught on. And I used to think that Carol was so much younger than me, and she wasn't. And she was a couple of years younger than me, but I always felt very, very old. I was very tired when I got here, very, very tired. And she taught me how to write my name. She figured I couldn't write my name. I did a lot of things of covering up that area of my life, and she spent hours. She had patience with half a gallon of Red Mountain wine, and I would sit, and I taught me how to write my name, and this other gal took me out of that place and moved me to Long Beach. I had a paper sack. I had a green card, and that was it. That was all I owned, and I decided if I got away from these Mexicans, that my life would be different, and it was all their fault. And all these well-meaning people in Long Beach would get me all these fancy jobs, and I said, no, I was going to do something different, and I did. I ended up in Anaheim Street, and Anaheim Street is Skid Row in Long Beach, and I was down there for 8 months. And while I was down there, I met this skinny, puny guy who I'm still living with him. It's 22 years today. And he came down there. He said he was sightseeing, and he asked me to date him. And I asked him if he had a job, and he said, no, he didn't work. And I said, I don't date guys who don't work. You have to get a job, you know. And he got a job, and he's been working ever since. And he was... He was very gentle, and he was very kind, and he was very, very different than anybody I've ever known. But I antagonized him, too. And he comes from a whole different background than I come from. He comes from Minnesota, and his family were very, very nice people, very gentle, very quiet. My family, when they told you they love you, they picked you up and threw you across the other end of the room. You know, I mean, they expressed themselves well with a lot of anger. I antagonized him to the point that he gave me two black eyes, and I knew that we were in love and we would have to get married. And we did. We got married. And we moved to Minnesota. We stayed there for a very brief time, and I decided I made a terrible mistake and divorced this man. We came back to California, and I had another one of those brainstorms, and I decided what I needed was a baby. Someone had told me that if I had a baby, I'd automatically grow up, and they lied one more time. I got pregnant, and 5 minutes after I'm pregnant, I don't want to be pregnant anymore. And there was five other girls in that apartment building. The doctor I went to put me in beer and wine. I used to have one glass of wine a day and one beer a day, and I was having half a gallon and a six-pack a day. I spent that 9 months by the toilet bowl is where I spent that 9 months. And there was five other girls in that apartment building that had babies, and they all went in, and they were so happy and came out, and I knew that my life was going to change just like theirs did, and I knew that it was all going to be okay. And I went in, I had that little girl, and I put that baby in my arms, and I didn't get those feelings. I didn't get those feelings. I didn't get that feeling of overwhelming feeling of love, and that everything was going to be great, and I was going to take care of her. I got an overwhelming feeling of responsibility, and what do we do now? I took that baby home, and I wanted to be a good mommy. And I don't know what a good mommy is even today. And this gal's 20 years of age, and she got accepted to one of the best universities in California. She's going to go to USC. I don't know where she's going to get the money, but she's going to USC. And she's got this. She was over in Cambridge last year in England. She went there for a semester, and she got to see my family. She went over to saw my brothers, and she said, they're all alcoholics. They're all drink. And then she went to Ireland, spent some time with my mother, and she came back, and she said, I'm so truly grateful, Mom, that you escaped all of that. And I thought, you better be more grateful than that. The Alcoholics Anonymous got a hold of me, because you might not be here. I might have killed you. I ended up with this little girl, and I wanted so desperately to be a good mommy with her, and I wasn't a good mommy. I abused this little girl. This little girl, in our first 7 years of her life, had nothing but black and blue marks all over her. And I remember when she was about 6 months old, I remember I abused her so bad. And I remember sitting in this chair, and I had half a gallon of wine. I hate telling you this, but I was no longer drinking out of the glass. I was just drinking out of the bottle. And I sitting there screaming at God. I hated him. Hated God with everything I had. I hated him. And I couldn't understand why he made somebody like me. Why wasn't I like Frances and Linda and those other girls? What was so wrong with me that I couldn't be like them? What was that thing that driven me that I had such a drive to destroy or to be destructful or to hurt or the need to do that, because I was just loaded with all of this stuff on inside of me. And I was sitting there drinking this, and I was screaming out loud. I hated him. I hated him with everything I had. I hated him. And you see, and I picked that baby up, and I threw him in bed. bed. And you see, I knew there was something desperately wrong with me when I was 19 years of age. That priest had come to me and he had sat by my bed. When I was 19, I'd gone to psychiatrists and I'd gone to priests and I'd looked for help. And that same priest came to me from St. Lawrence's Church over there in Torrance, and he came to me at that hospital. He gave me the last rites. I was bleeding internally and they couldn't stop the bleeding, and they thought I was going to die after I had run off the freeway with that guy. And I really didn't care whether I died or not. Life was too hard and I wished I had to. And he said, he gave me the last rites, and he sat by my bed and he said, Annie, he said, surely, he said, you better start praying. He said, because surely if you die tonight, you will burn in the fires of hell, because it's what you've been doing in your life. And I remember groping for that rosary. I remember picking it up and I remember throwing it at him and saying, you take your rosary and you take your God and you get the hell out of my life. Because if there is such a place called hell, I'm living it. I'm living it right between my ears. I'm living it. And my life did not change for the better at that time. It continued to get worse. And I picked that baby up and I threw him in bed and I went out to those bars and I did the same thing. And as I did married, as I did sober, because you see, I thought, now do I had a license to say and do whatever I wanted to do? And I found out that men hit just as hard whether you're married or you're not married. It really doesn't make any difference to you when you to them when you're saying the things that are coming out of my mouth. This man gave me an ultimatum. He told me I had to do something or I would have to. He was going to take that little girl and he was going to leave. And that was the very, very first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told about Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 19 years of age, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I knew it was going to be different when I got married. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I looked around and I didn't want to be one. And I stayed long enough to get a message, I did. But there was a gal there, her name was Carolyn C. at that time. She's Carolyn O. now. And Carolyn had taken me to meetings. And in the 8 months when I left Alcoholics Anonymous, Carolyn would call me. And then I decided that it was a recruiting thing. And I would, she would call me up and she'd say, I want to be your friend. And I'd say, I only had so much to drink. And she'd say, I don't care how much you had to drink. I want to be your friend. And God, I longed for a friend. But to be her friend, the price was too high. And I most certainly did not want to sit in those hard chairs and go to those meetings to be her friend. And then I got this brilliant idea that what it was a recruiting thing, and I would recruit somebody for you, and I would get you to off my back, right? So I called this friend of mine in Long Beach, and I said, Eileen, you're an alcoholic, and you ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, okay. So I called this gal back, and I said, I found somebody for you. And she said, good. She said, I'll come and get both of you. And I thought, that wasn't the idea, but I went anyway. I went to a meeting, went over to the Anaheim Club in Anaheim, and there was another gal there. Her name was Sue M. And I was standing there, and Eileen was with us. And Sue looked at me, and she said, Annie, when are you coming back? And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. She is. Look at her. And, you know, God works in strange and mysterious ways. You know, I left that meeting, and every time I picked up a drink, I would hear that woman say, when are you coming back? I want to tell you, my last drunk, and I hope it's my last drunk, I'm absolutely, totally positive that I have another drunk left in me. I know without a shadow of a doubt I don't have another recovery left in me. I could not go through the process one more time. You know, I could not go through the first 5 years of my sobriety again. If you had to tell me what I was to experience in my first 5 years of sobriety, I would have told you, you take your program and shove it, because I'm most certainly not going to stay here to go through that. And my last drunk, I believe, is all the people that I drank with all died, and they all died horrible, horrible deaths. Billy D and Leona, they were the last two people I drank with, and both of them died of cirrhosis of the liver. Horrible, horrible way to go. And I ended up in that day, I've been drinking for 4 days straight. I'd left that little girl. I got beat up one more time, and my husband had left. He no longer, from that time that he went to the AA meeting with me, he no longer chased me down in bars. He no longer looked for me. And I would be gone 10 days at a time, and I'd call him up, and I'd say, if you straighten up and fly right, I'll come home, you know. I mean, I still blamed. Of anything I've learned here, I've learned to take responsibility for Annie, and I didn't do that for a long time. I wanted you to take responsibility for me. I ended up my last drunk, and I ended up, someone took me out of there, four guys took me out of there and took me home, dropped me off. I wasn't drunk and I wasn't sober, and I should have been blacked out, passed out, and something should have been happening to me. And I went in the house and I called Ireland for the last time, and my dad hung up on me. And my neighbor came across the street, and this woman never stayed up past 10 o'clock in her life, but she came across the street that night and she told me to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that you didn't have the answer for me either, because I knew my case was different. And she said, go back there to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I can't. They don't understand me there either. And my husband, she located him. He came home. He took a look at me and he left. And I don't know what happened between 2 o'clock and the next morning, but something happened. And I got up and I sat in this chair and I saw where I was going. I'm a gal that came off of Beacon Street in San Pedro. And this man had picked me off of Anaheim Street and dusted me off and tried to give me some semblance of a home and a life. And I didn't want to go it. I didn't want to go it. I didn't want to go back to Beacon Street, nor did I want to go back to Anaheim Street in Long Beach. And they tell me that that is a moment of clarity. And that little girl who was 22 months at that time was standing there with little eyes sunken in her head, the little black, dark eyes she's got, and her little legs all black and blue, and her little diaper's half off of her, and this man sat over in this other chair, and I can see it like it was yesterday, and his head is hanging down, and he's wringing his hands, and I said, I'm going to call that gal. I want to be my friend. And he said, you go right ahead. He said, you've never completed anything in your life. He said, you won't stay there either. And I said, I can't. I'm not doing it for you, and I'm not doing it for her. I can't live in myself anymore. I got to go see what those people have. And I called that gal. I want to be my friend. And that was on June 16, 1968. And Carolyn came and got me, and she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was shaking so bad. And I sat by the door, and I sat in my hands, and I was so deadly sick inside. And I wanted to follow. I wanted, and God, I would have cheated me so badly if this is all I was going to get out of this deal. I really would have truly cheated me. All I wanted was, please stop my head from racing, take this knot out of the pit of my gut, and make the shakes go away. That's all I wanted. And a man stood up here like I am tonight, and God, I'll never want to forget it. And he stood up, and all I heard was, and this is what I heard from me, and he said, that was the first drink that got you drunk. And I didn't know it was the first drink that got me drunk. I always thought it was the sixth drink that got me drunk. He told me that I suffered a threefold disease. It was an allergy to the body, coupled with obsession to the mind. I was spiritually sick. And he told me that I could get sober and I could stay sober the same way I drank. Now I'm a daily drinker and a periodic drunk. And I left that meeting, and I'd like to tell you, I never wanted to drink again. I wanted to drink more than anything in my life. I wanted to drink. God, I was thirsty. I wanted to drink more than anything, because you hadn't done the one thing I wanted you to do that morning. You know, typical newcomer, I wanted 10 years and 10 minutes, you know, right now. I don't want to go through all of this pain. I want it now. I wanted you to stop my head from racing, take the knot out of the pit of my gut, and make the shakes go away, and you hadn't done that, and I wanted to drink, because I knew that if I had one lousy drink, I never had one of anything in my life, but if I had one lousy drink, I would stop the shakes, and it would take the knot out of the pit of my gut, and I would make my head stop racing, and I would be okay. And I heard the man say, you don't take the first drink, and you don't get drunk. And I didn't take that first drink, and I went to a lot of meetings. I was 9 months sober, 9 months pregnant, and I gave birth to a baby boy, and I wanted to be a good mommy to this baby boy, and I brought that baby boy home. And something very special happened, because in my first 9 months of sobriety, I wanted to drink, and I just was trying to get out of here. I tried everything to get out of here. I didn't want to stay here. I had an obsession to drink, so I was so thirsty. And I didn't drink simply because I was pregnant, and because they kept picking me up and dragging me to meetings. Every time I turned around, there was someone at my door taking me to another meeting. And what happened was, when I gave birth to that baby boy, was something inside of me. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says it so well. It says that when we admit to our animal selves, we're alcoholics, that is the first step in recovery. And I admitted to my animal self that I was an alcoholic, and that was the first step in recovery for me. And I brought that baby boy home, and I thought, now that I'm sober, everything's going to be wonderful, and I'm going to be a good mommy. And I wasn't a good mommy. I abused that little baby boy, and I abused that little girl, and I abused that husband. I was 2 years sober, and I went home to Ireland, and that was a disaster. Total disaster when I went to Ireland. I found out I was pregnant one more time, and I didn't want to be pregnant. I go to Ireland when I miss the agony, as I do, so I always take a little trip over there to get reminded. And found out I was pregnant again, and I didn't want to be pregnant again, and the sponsor, and my sponsor at that time was a beautiful lady, and that woman was there all the time. Sponsors are so important. This woman was so important to me. This woman was everything to me, everything. She was my mother, she was my sister, she was my friend. It didn't matter what time, day or night I called that woman, she was there. God, I love Lois so much. We're so very, very close today. And that woman would come, and she would take those babies out of that house because she knew what I was doing. This is all in sobriety. I didn't get well when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of those that got so sick in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would frantically run in and out of meetings, and for 1.5 hours, I would be okay. 1.5 hours, I was safe, sane, and sober. And I would leave that meeting, and I would go out, and I was absolutely all this turmoil. I was like a little kid. I just had to be here so that I could just feel you around me, even though I couldn't let you come near me. Nobody ever came near me because the hair would stand on my arm, and I'd get so terrified, and I'd say, don't touch me. Please don't touch me. I was terrified of you because I thought if you just really knew what I was like, you wouldn't really want me. And I was 2.5 years sober, and I got to share this with you. Because if you're having trouble, I really feel that we lose a lot of people between 2.5 and 3 years of sobriety, because that's when the pain starts, and that's when the growing starts, and that's when we have to change, and we have to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and work in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't have to happen this way for everybody. This is how it happened for me. And I was 2.5 years sober, and I beat my son, and I beat him, and I beat him, and I beat him, and I beat him till his eyes rolled up in his little head. And you know those coincidences that you talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, those happen to me every day. Every day, there's a little coincidence. The phone rings or someone comes by. And this particular day, this man came by. He was 10 miles away from home. He came to my house. And he stopped at my house for a cup of coffee, and he came in the middle of this whole scene. And you see, I had so much rage and so much anger in me. I was so terrified of my anger. I used to go in blackouts, in anger and sobriety. I mean, the rage was absolutely unbelievable. And he took that baby away from me, and I stood there. And I thought, the only thing I knew was I wasn't to drink and I wasn't to run. And he just very quietly, very calmly said, "You called somebody." And I called Mary Ann. Or Mary Lee, and he held that baby, and Mary Lee came and got me and took me to a meeting. I went into a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat in that meeting, and I said, "Please help me. Somebody help me. I can't live and do what I'm doing to me, my kids. I just can't do it. Please help me." Somebody said something to me. I understand so much today why I didn't drive, why the whole setting was. Because I would have killed myself or killed somebody. Somebody said something to me, and I ran out of the meeting. And a lady came out after me, and she grabbed a hold of me, and I cried. I couldn't cry for the first 3 years I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a guy in my home group, his name was Walt Stiles. And Walt used to go up a podium, and he would cry, and I would sit, and I'd white knuckle, and I'd say, "Why does he cry? Why does he cry?" I know why Walt cried today. Walt died some years ago. Walt was one of those people that loved you unconditionally. And he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He loved it so much. It was his whole life. And I used to sit in this chair at home, and I would feel it come up, and I would feel the lump here. And Jim talked about that crying last night, and I would swallow real hard, and I'd say, "No, I'm not going to cry." Because crying truly is the sign of weakness, and I'm not going to be weak here. A guy held me one night while another one punched my face, and I said, "You go right ahead and you kill me, because I ain't going to cry." I had got so hard and so cold inside of me. And that woman came out after me, and I lay in her arms like a baby, and I cried, and I cried. And I cried. And I thought I was never going to stop crying. I thought that my whole life was just going to go down in a big pool of blood, of water, and that would be it. And that woman held me. And I know today, and I understand it so well, that tears are truly the cleansing of one's soul. God made tears because my soul needed so much cleansing, and she took me to Orange County Psycho. I did not stay at Orange County Psycho, but this was she took me. I was to find a psychologist there, and I'm not here for to give you a plug for a psychologist, but my big book in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my big book, it says that those professional people are there to help us, and it also goes on to talk about the men of the plot, and for us not to scoff at anything they have to say, because they do have some knowledge that we need to have. And that man told me that he wanted to help me, and I said, "There isn't." He said, "I want to help you." He said, "And work you through this thing." And he also told me, he said, "You want somebody to love you." And I said, "There isn't anybody that loves me. I couldn't love me, and I couldn't love anybody. And I knew there was nobody that loved me. I never felt loved. Never felt it." And this man said to me, "There's got to be somebody that loves you." And I said, "There isn't anybody that loves me." He said, "What about those people in Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Those people in Alcoholics Anonymous tolerate me. Because their only requirement for a membership is a desire to stop drinking, and God only knows they know I have a desire to stop drinking." This woman who was my sponsor told me on a daily basis, she told me on a daily basis that God loved me, she loved me, and I was a child of God. And I never heard it. I'm one of those that believes that we hear when we're ready to hear, we see when we're ready to see. And I went to that woman, I left that office that day from that doctor, and little Al-Anon lady had taken me over there because I didn't drive, and she used to take me back and forth twice a week. This little Al-Anon lady took me back and forth. And she dropped me, and I called Lois up, and I whispered very whispery on the phone. I said, "Lois, do you love me?" She said, "Annie, I love you so much." I came to believe that there was somebody that could love me. I didn't love you. And I'm still not one that says, "Do I love everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous?" Some of you are much easier to love than others. And if I'm loving me, I love you that much more. But if I'm not loving you and there's something going on in my life, I don't love you. Because I'm envious of you, and I'm thinking you've got it and I don't. And I have to work on a lot of that. But most of the time today, I love a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't stop abusing my children right away. I started to touch them. I love my kids today. I got three children, three of the most beautiful kids you ever want to meet. And they really, really seem to be very well adjusted. I don't try to be a mommy today. We're all growing together, and I keep telling my oldest girl, she's older than me, she's 20, I'm only 19, you know, I mean, after all, what do you expect, you know? They seem to be doing very, very well without me being in there, giving them any kind of guidance. I ended up, when I was 5 years sober, nobody had ever asked me to be their sponsor, nobody. Old-timers used to grab those newcomers and kind of move them away. They were so... They were so afraid I was going to contaminate those newcomers, they would kind of move them over. And this little gal came to Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she asked me to be her sponsor. Her name was Cindy. She was a little blonde girl. And she used a lot of LSD and a lot of drugs, and she was a full-blown alcoholic, and she was so paranoid and so scared. And she came into a meeting, and she asked me, and I told her I would share with her what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Cindy came into a meeting one night, and she was 6 weeks clean and sober, and she sat by the door, and she was hallucinating. And I went over to her, and I took her out of that meeting. Now, I had never felt this feeling for anybody. I never felt it. I didn't feel it for my kids when I put in my arms. I had accepted the things I couldn't change. I accepted the fact that I did not have love inside of me, and that was the way it was going to be. And that when God was ready to do that, and it has to come to me in a feeling. If it doesn't come to me in a feeling, it is no good to me at all. It has to be a feeling for me. And I took that little girl out of that meeting, and I went into the bathroom, and I sat on the floor with her, and I rocked her like a baby. I rocked her like a baby in my arms, and she looked at me with the bluest eyes I've ever seen in anybody, and she said, Annie, you love me so much. And the tears ran down my face, and it was like electricity went through my body, and the hair stood in my arms, and I looked at her, and I said, God, Cindy, yes, I do love you so much. I felt love for the first time for another human being. I didn't feel that when they put my babies in my arms. I got it from a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am one that believes that it's not so much what I can give you, it's what I have to learn through you when you come into my life. And some of you come in for a very, very short time. Some of you will not come in at all. And some of you will come in for a very long time, and you will walk with me for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. But every time you come in and every time I touch your life together, I learn something and you learn something from me. I was 7 years sober. I made another big drastic decision in my life, and the big decision in my life, and like I said earlier, I was never good at making decisions. I decided to send my kids to Catholic school. I'd like to tell you that I had good motives behind that. The motive behind that was I was going to get back at all those rotten nuns for all the rotten things that they done to me. And what happened with that was I ended up working at the Catholic school with these nuns, and I made amends to these nuns. I didn't make the ones in Ireland, but I made amends to these nuns, and I worked at the Catholic school for the next 6 years in the library, and they paid me. And I was absolutely ecstatic about that. I could not believe they wanted to pay me. And I remember they said they wanted me to be assistant librarian and they were willing to pay me. You know, the Catholics are always looking for money. They never pay you for anything. And so I thought, oh my God, if they know, I'll never be able to do it. So I went home and I called somebody and I said, they want me to take a job and they want me to pay me for it. And this girl, Sandra, said to me, she said, did you take it? I said, no. And she said, Annie, she said, how it works is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And willingness is the key. She said, you go back down there and you tell them that you're going to take that job. And I did. And I worked there for 6 years and I made amends to those nuns. And I was one of the best things I ever did. I got a couple of priests sober down there. Did you hear that? I got a couple of priests sober down there. I carried the message to this one priest in the confession, and it wasn't a very, very nice way how I carried a message to him, and so he ended up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Father Joe Morin, and Joe and I became real, real good friends, and I used to walk across that little parking lot, and Sister Margaret Devine used to see me come across with Joe, and I'd introduce her as Joe, and she'd say, well, he's father, with her little Irish brogue, and I'd say, he's Joe to me, sister, I'm not going to call him father. And I had some of the most wonderful times with that man, and what I learned from that man and from those nuns was that they're spiritually sick too. And that they, you know, with all those learnings that they get, they don't have it. They don't have a pipeline to God no more than we do, you know? And that was also a freedom for me. I was 11 years sober and I went home. My dad is gone now. I've lost several people in my family in the last couple of years. My sister died of cancer to breast. And my brother-in-law is an alcoholic, and it was a horrible, horrible time in my life. My brother died 4 months exactly to the day from cancer of the lungs. This has all happened in the last couple of years. So we can stay sober regardless of what's going on. I'd like to tell you I come from priests and nuns. I don't. I come from alcoholics. My dad died from alcoholism and other things. But when I was 11 years sober, I went home and I wanted something from my dad. My dad always said I was no good and never would be any good. And I always believed that. And I wanted him to tell me that he loved me. And he's ready to make an announcement. And I'm ready to finish. And I wanted him to tell me that he loved me. And he never could tell me that he loved me. But when I was home at that time, there was seven of us home at that time, and he called us all in the bedroom and he told us he hated us, hated every one of us. That every one of us was terrible mistakes and every one of us should have been drowned at birth. And you know, I grabbed onto that mistake and my brothers reached for a drink and I heard the word mistake and I just didn't want to be a mistake anymore. When I came to you 19 years ago, you told me that I wasn't a mistake. And I don't ever want to be a mistake. I read a lot today, and I read Gibran, the prophet. And there's a line in there, and it says, there are children come through us, they're not of us. And I came through those people. I'm not of those people. I'm of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you are the people. You're the ones that walked the extra mile with me when nobody else would walk with me. You're the ones that sat and held my hand when nobody else would sit and hold my hand. You're the ones that saw Nanny that nobody else could see. You still see her today. And you're the ones that walk with me when nobody else would walk with me, and I walk tall with dignity today because I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless each and every one of you.